Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
What are the landmark legal cases regarding teaching the controversy over evolution? I'm Keith Pinnock, and today on our show, we continue a radio interview that Policy and Legal Affairs Officer Casey Luskin did with ARN's Kevin Wirth, where they discuss just that.
Welcome back once again to the Darwiner Design Show. I'm your guest host, Kevin Wirth, sitting in for Dr. Tom Woodward, and we're visiting with our special guest and attorney, Casey Luskin. We're talking about Casey's survey of the key legal cases tied to evolution and public policy as it relates to Darwinism, evolution, and intelligent design issues. So the next segment in your article, Casey, deals with cases rejecting the teaching of alternatives to evolution. And the first case I'd like us to touch on here is the Edwards v. Aguillard case. What's the key information you want our listeners to come away with on that?
Sure. Well, the Edwards case was the second case regarding the teaching of origins to reach the U.S. Supreme Court. It was handed down in 1987, and the basic rule that comes out of that case is that it is illegal to advocate creationism in public schools because creationism postulates a, quote, supernatural creator, unquote. That's a direct language from the ruling. So basically, that's the main legal rule that comes out of this case, that creationism is unconstitutional, and there's a handful of lower court decisions that I also survey in this Law Review article that interpret Edwards as having declared the teaching of creationism to be unconstitutional. Now, there is other important language that comes out of this case. We talked about it a little bit earlier in this segment, in this interview, and that is that in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court basically said that it is permissible to teach scientific critiques of prevailing scientific theories, provided that you're doing that with the legitimate secular purpose to enhance and improve the effectiveness of science education. And so I think that's a very important point that we should keep in mind, that although they said that creationism is a religious alternative to evolution that cannot be advocated in public schools, that does not mean that it is illegal to teach scientific critiques of evolution. And that's a very important point that we should not forget from this case. And I think that it's a very good ruling in that sense, that it protects the teaching of good science in public schools.
Casey, can you give us a really quick and succinct summary of the Lemon Test and
Sure.
the different prongs of that test?
Yeah, the Lemon Test is probably the primary judicial rule that is used to decide cases that are dealing with the Establishment Clause. Basically, when someone brings a lawsuit saying that the government has established religion in one form or another, the primary legal test that is used is called the Lemon Test. It comes out of a case called Lemon versus Kurtzman that was decided in the early 1970s. And there are three parts to this test. And if a government policy fails any one of those three parts, then it is unconstitutional. And so I'll try to quote these close to being verbatim, but this is basically what the test says. First, the government policy must have been enacted for a legitimate secular purpose. If there is a religious purpose that predominates, then the policy is unconstitutional. The second prong, so to speak, is that the principal or primary effect of the policy must be one that neither inhibits nor advances religion. And so in this case, in the case of Edwards versus Aguillard, they actually found that it was enacted for a religious purpose and therefore it was unconstitutional. But then other cases have interpreted Edwards, the ruling which said that creationism is a religious viewpoint, that if you're advocating creationism, then the effect of that policy is to advance religion. I'm sorry, and keep in mind, it has to be the primary effect. You can have secondary or incidental effects that might touch upon religion, and that would not mean that the policy is illegal.
Yeah, because they said that the religious purpose alone is not enough to invalidate an act of a state legislature, and for a law to be unconstitutional, the religious purpose must predominate, right?
That's right. The religious purpose has to predominate. And then as far as the second prong is concerned, it has to be the primary effect that advances religion. There's a whole long line of cases going very far back that find that if the secondary or incidental effect touches upon religion, that is okay. It has to be the primary effect that, and in this case, courts have found that the primary effect of teaching creationism would be illegal. The third prong of the Lemon Test is that there cannot be excessive entanglement between government and religion. And many courts actually just focus on the first two prongs called the purpose prong and the effect prong. They don't deal so much with the third prong, the entanglement prong. So really, I think that if you're using the Lemon Test in a court case, the primary issue is, what is the motive or the purpose behind the policy? Was it religious or secular? And then two, what is the effect of that policy? Is its primary effect to advance or inhibit religion? And if it is, then the policy is going to be struck down as unconstitutional.
Okay, great. Now, in the dissenting opinion in this case, Edwards v. Aguiar, I noticed Justice Scalia was concerned over the court's attempt to determine the motives of legislators. Scalia commented that if we were to get rid of folks who had religious purpose in mind, then we would never have abolished slavery. We would have not be able to bring relief for famine victims, et cetera, et cetera. This is an issue that's always kind of grabbed me, and that is, you know, explain to us a little bit about how important it is, what the motivations are. In my view, I kind of agree with Scalia. It shouldn't matter what your motives are as long as the effect is, it turns out to be secular and consistent with secular purpose.
Well, Justice Scalia is very famous for his biting dissenting opinions, and his dissenting opinion in the Edwards versus Aguilar case is no exception to that that reputation that he has. Basically, what he argues is that the Lemon Test purpose prong, which, as we said earlier, requires that the purpose behind a government policy be secular, is not a very good legal test, because what he says is that there are some very beneficial and very important policies that have been enacted in our society. As you mentioned, the abolition movement was very largely motivated by religious persons who felt that in their religious views, there were equality of all persons. And obviously, this is an extremely good thing that has happened in our society, the abolition of slavery, or bringing equality to people of all racial and ethnic backgrounds. The civil rights movement was very much motivated by religion. So on what grounds should we be invalidating a policy that has all these wonderful secular benefits simply because the people behind it had religious motives? And what he says is that really the motives behind a policy are not a very good test for whether that policy should be allowed or not. Really what should stand is, and I think, you know, this is probably good reasoning, is the effect of the policy. Is it religious or not? Whether the motives are you know, are religious or not really do not necessarily have a bearing on whether or not it's a good policy that should be maintained in our society. This brings me to actually, if we can skip ahead a little bit, probably the worst reasoned decision that I review in this article is the Selman versus Cobb County case. In that case, the judge found that not only do the religious motives of the government agents, the government legislators matter, but sometimes the actual religious motives and beliefs of the people, the citizens in the community, can invalidate a policy. And in that case, the judge found that because the school district had actually adopted a policy that was being advocated by persons in the community who were religious, that therefore the policy was unconstitutional. Now, I want our listeners to understand the gravity of the terribleness of this decision. It basically takes away the political rights of religious persons to engage in the political process. It says if you are religious and the government agrees with your viewpoint, even if it is a completely secular viewpoint, because you are religious, the government's policy is therefore unconstitutional. Now, thankfully, this ruling was basically deleted by a higher court who found that the factual record in this case was so messy that the higher court was unable to determine whether the judge had actually made correct findings. So this case does not stand as a point of law, but the reason in this case is so terrible that it basically removes the rights of religious persons to engage in the political process in this country. It is absolutely atrocious. What's interesting, though, in that case is that there were atheists who were also advocating that the school district take a different position. So what would have happened if the district had agreed with the atheists? Well, would they have then been equally unconstitutional? So the logic in this case is just terrible. The bottom line is that whether you are religious or an atheist, you should have an equal right to participate in the political process in this country. Atheists, religious persons, non-religious persons shall have equal rights to advocate for positions, and it shouldn't matter.
Yep.
And
so, but, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Boy, so Casey, let's jump to the Bishop case. What are the key things that our listeners need to pick up from this case?
Well, the Bishop case is a case where a university professor was told to stop teaching a certain class and a certain subject on the grounds that he was teaching creationism and therefore establishing religion. Now, what's interesting about this case is that it basically is dealing with the university level, where professors tend to have more academic freedom than obviously a high school teacher does. I don't think that this case is necessarily the final law on the subject, because what happened in this case was that the court actually did not reach a determination of whether the professor's speech did or did not establish religion. And that's a very important point, because the court basically abdicated, you know, its responsibility to give clear guidelines to administrators and educators as to exactly what constitutes religion and what does not constitute religion. It is the court's job to define clear lines of what can and cannot be said in the classroom. And in this case, the court basically created this zone of haziness where basically if it is unclear whether it establishes religion, they're going to simply defer to the administration and say that, okay, you can shut down teacher speech in this zone of haziness if you choose to do so. If you choose to shut down this teacher speech, we're going to defer to your discretion here, but we're not going to define a clear line as to exactly what does or does not violate the Constitution. So I think in this case, the court was really failing in its responsibility to create clear constitutional lines for both teachers and administrators and students, really, to understand what can and cannot be said in the classroom.
So would you say that in this case, that the courts granted the university the right to shut down the speech of a professor in view of his potential ability or coming close to violating whatever their policies might have been?
Yeah, it was about potential, and it was about, were the administrators acting reasonably? I think if they're acting reasonably, then we should know that based upon a clear ruling from the court that what the teacher was saying was or was not constitutional. If it was unconstitutional, then fine. They were acting reasonably. If the court finds that it was not unconstitutional, then I think you should say that the administrators were not acting reasonably.
And again, in this kind of an instance, would it be helpful for educators to have policies at hand that have been, you know, put out there by the university?
Well, yeah, the more guidance that you can give educators and teachers, the better. I think that the problem that we find so often in this issue is that teachers are unclear about their rights. They don't know what they can or cannot say in the classroom regarding the teaching of topics like evolution. And so they just sit in fear constantly, worrying about what they can or cannot do.
Okay, Casey, we've got 2 minutes left. Biggest, saving the biggest and best for last, Kitzmiller.
The Kitzmiller versus Dover case was a case from the lowest level of the courts, the federal district courts in Pennsylvania in 2005, where a small school district in Pennsylvania taught intelligent design, required the teaching of intelligent design, and a federal judge found it unconstitutional. I'm going to give you a quick laundry list of what was wrong with this decision, if that's okay. And there's a much more extensive discussion in my article and also in a Montana Law Review article that I co-authored with John West and David DeWolf in 2007. So what did the judge get wrong in this case? Well, for one, he incorrectly defined ID by presuming that ID requires supernatural creation, even though that was a position that was refuted during the trial by ID proponents. He ignored the positive case for ID, falsely claiming that ID proponents make their case solely by arguing against evolution. He overstepped the bounds of the judiciary and engaged in judicial activism by trying to decide very broad questions about whether ID is science or religion. He used poor philosophy of science by turning science into a voting contest, and he blatantly ignored and denied the existence of pro-ID peer-reviewed scientific publications and research and data that was in fact testified about in his own courtroom. There's a whole lot of other things that the judge got wrong in this case, but the bottom line is that we should keep in mind that one judge does not settle the issue of whether ID is science or religion, nor does he negate the huge amounts of data in the scientific and biology that support ID.
Thanks, Casey. And again, listeners can go to www.discovery.org/A/11291 and read the full text of Casey's article. Casey, unfortunately, we're at the end of our time for the show, but we sure have enjoyed having you share your thoughts. You're a great expert on this topic, and it's been an honor to have you with us. And we all wish you the best as you continue to work on providing us with more of your work on this important issue. We're at the end of our show for today, and thanks once again for listening. I'm Kevin Wirth, and we'll see you next time.
I'm Keith Pinnock with ID the Future, and thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.